This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Our mission today is, well, it's pretty straightforward. We are taking this mountain of research, biography, and analysis on one of America's most, you know, enduring artists, John J. Mellencamp.
And we're going to distill his really remarkable and constantly evolving career into the essential knowledge you need.
Exactly. We're heading straight into the heartland to understand how a kid from Seymour, Indiana, could transform from this reluctant, almost manufactured pop star named Johnny Cougar into a truly authentic, critically revered folk rock elder statesman. It's an incredible story of artistic perseverance.
It really is.
And when you study Mellencamp, you're really studying the evolution of American popular music in miniature. We start with rock and roll, of course.
Sure.
But then it quickly shifts into heartland rock, roots rock, and especially folk rock. What really defines him is his insistence on traditional acoustic instrumentation, fiddles, dulcimers, mandolins, fused with this classic hard rock rhythm section.
It's like he has a foot firmly planted in the 19th century and the other in the 21st.
That's a great way to put it.
And he did all this while staying profoundly tied to his Indiana roots. I mean, he built a global career without ever having to move his creative home base.
Which is so rare.
So before we even dive into those messy, you know, cougar years, let's just quickly look at the scale of his achievement. Because the numbers, they really confirm his status as an American institution.
The output is astounding. Uh-huh. He was born John J. Mellencamp on October 7th, 1951, in Seymour, Indiana.
Right.
And he is just relentlessly prolific. We're talking 25 studio albums. The formal recognition he's garnered, it really speaks to his quality and longevity. He's a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Inducted in 2008.
And maybe even more importantly, he was welcomed into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2018.
So he has the critical accolades. He's got the deep catalog.
Yeah.
But he also dominated the commercial charts, didn't he? He wasn't just critically acclaimed. He was a hit machine, even if he didn't always, you know, like the hits.
Oh, absolutely. He had massive commercial success, accumulating 14 top 20 singles. But here's the little stat that often surprises people.
Okay.
He holds the solo artist record for the most number one singles on the Hot Mainstream Rock Tracks chart. Seven of them.
Seven. Wow.
Over his career, he's sold more than 60 million albums worldwide, with 30 million of those sales right here in the U.S.
Those are just enormous metrics.
Yeah.
But his legacy, as we all know, it extends so far beyond record sales and chart positions. It goes right into the heart of American activism. You really can't talk about Mellencamp without immediately talking about Farm Aid.
Farm Aid is a defining pillar of his entire identity. He co-founded it in September 1985 with Willie Nelson and Neil Young.
The big three.
The big three. And the goal was simple. Raise awareness and, you know, critical funds about the growing crisis of family farms being lost.
And the success is just, it's measurable.
Completely. That concert has become an annual institution running for 39 years now. And as of 2024, the organization has raised nearly $80
million. $80
million. That's not just charity. That is an ongoing, focused commitment to a very specific social cause that is deeply tied to his public image as the voice of the heartland.
$80 million over nearly four decades. That kind of commitment is almost unparalleled in the music world. It's a powerful foundation to build on. But as we dive in, we have to start at the beginning, where that powerful image was nearly destroyed by a simple branding decision.
Okay, let's unpack this journey, because the path to becoming John Mellencamp was anything but direct. Our material confirms he had music in his blood from the very beginning. He formed his first band, Crepe Soul, at what, age 14?
Yeah, just a kid. He was dedicated, but his path was winding. After high school, he went to Vincennes University starting in 72 and kept playing in local Indiana bands.
And you can see his early interest in exploring different styles, which, you know, becomes a hallmark of his later career.
Definitely. One of his early local bands, for instance, was a glam rock outfit called Trash.
Trash.
Named for a New York doll song. That's a long, long way from the fiddles and mandolins of Scarecrow. It really is. It's also important to note, before we even get to the professional obstacles, that his life began with a major health challenge. That probably informed his later tenacity.
Absolutely. Mellencamp was born with spina bifida and had to have corrective surgery as an infant. He started his career already knowing what it felt like to overcome these huge physical obstacles.
That kind of early adversity often translates into a deep-seated drive.
For sure. Though perhaps the biggest obstacle he faced initially was much more mundane, his own name.
Right. And here is the origin story of what was probably the biggest artistic betrayal of his career, the name game. He's hustling between Indiana and New York City in 74, 75, and he links up with Tony DeFreeze of Main Man Management.
And DeFreeze, who was a high-powered manager, was just resolute. John J. Mellencamp was not a rock star name.
He'd managed Bowie, right,
yeah,
and Iggy Pop.
The very same. So he had this idea of what a star was, and he deemed Mellencamp totally unmarketable. So for the release of his first album, Chestnut Street Incident, in 1976.
He gets rebranded.
Against his will as Johnny Cougar. The sources all confirm Mellencamp reluctantly agreed, just seeing it as a necessary evil to break into the industry.
It's so easy to dismiss this as just, you know, music business theater. But this forced identity was a deep source of anguish for him. He was a Heartland kid, a serious songwriter, being marketed as this sort of glam, slightly sleazy character.
And the irony is, the forced rebranding was a massive failure.
A total flop.
Chestnut Street Incident was a brutal commercial flop. It sold only 12,000 copies.
12,000. For an artist being managed by the same team that launched Bowie, that's shocking.
It must have made him question the entire premise of the commercial machine. He later said those years felt like he was a puppet, forced to record songs he disliked and assume an image that was just entirely false.
So after he parts with DeFreeze, things start to improve, but only subtly. He signs with Riva Records, and in 78, a biography comes out.
Right, but not even in the U.S. initially, which is telling.
But that record had I Need a Lover on it.
And that song managed to become a top five hit in Australia, so it's getting traction somewhere. It was eventually included on his 1979 U.S. self-titled album, John Cougar.
And we should note, that song's resonance was so strong that Pat Benatar recorded a cover of it for her explosive debut album, In the Heat of the Night.
Which brought it even more visibility, so you can tell the material was starting to catch on, but the name still felt false to him.
He kept charting in the early 80s, like the 1980 album Nothing Matters and What If It Did. That one had top 40 singles.
It did, but this is where that artistic tension we mentioned really begins to show. He was incredibly self-critical of this period. He later just dismissed the singles from that album tracks like This Time and Ain't Even Done With the Night as stupid little pop songs.
That really speaks to a deep frustration, doesn't it? He's a talented writer trying to create meaningful, rootsy music, but he only gets rewarded when he produces what he considers, you know, throwaway pop.
Exactly. I mean, if he felt that anguish, you have to ask, why didn't he fight the name change immediately? Was he secretly enjoying the hits, or did he just not have the power?
It had to be leverage. Or a lack of it.
It was almost certainly leverage. Artists in those early deals have very little power. He needed a true commercial blockbuster to even be able to force the conversation with the label.
And he got it. He got it with the 1982 album American Fool.
That album was the pivot. It was the monster commercial breakthrough that finally gave him the influence he desperately craved.
American Fool changed everything overnight. It had two massive, era-defining hits. Hurts So Good,
which peaked at number two for 4 weeks straight.
And the iconic Jack and Diane, which held the number one spot for 4 weeks.
This success didn't just validate his songwriting. It gave him the commercial clout to start dictating terms. And the album also earned him the Grammy for Best Male Rock Vocal Performance in 1983 for Hurts So Good.
So after this huge success, he's got the influence and he wields it immediately to reclaim his identity.
Well, halfway.
Right, halfway.
The success of American Fool allowed him to force the label to finally add his real surname to his stage name. So the next album, in 1983, was the first release billed as John Cougar Mellencamp. The battle was slowly being won.
And, continued the success. It had Pink Houses, Crumbling Down, but it also had Authority Song. That song is interesting because he specifically linked it to classic rock rebellion.
He described it as our version of I Fought the Law. This wasn't just a nod to the Crickets or the Clash. It was a clear statement that he was moving beyond the stupid little pop songs and back toward that feisty, rebellious spirit of classic rock and roll.
Music that challenged the status quo.
It was the moment he fused commercial viability with lyrical grit.
This era also established the legendary backing band that would define his Heartland sound for the next decade. Their stability and power, I think, are often overlooked when people talk about his success.
The band stabilized into a legendary unit during this period. The lineup, Kenny Aronoff on drums, Larry Crane and Mike Wanchuk on guitars, Toby Myers on bass, and John Casella on keyboards, was so potent that Rolling Stone magazine in 1988 called it one of the most powerful and versatile live bands ever assembled.
That is some high praise. What made them so special, particularly Aronoff's drumming?
Aronoff's drumming was the engine. He had this almost militaristic bare-knuckle precision combined with a real Heartland swagger. It perfectly grounded the Roots instrumentation that he was about to introduce.
And the guitars.
Wanchuk and Crane offered that classic rock guitar framework, which let Mellencamp experiment, knowing he had this incredibly versatile and powerful sonic foundation to fall back on. The stability of that lineup is what allowed him to push his music into entirely new genres without losing that essential rock core.
It's just a remarkable transformation, tracing his path from the reluctant Johnny Cougar to the artist who finally found the leverage to be himself, culminating in this powerhouse band. And that transformation prepared him.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
For the real creative deep dive, the invention of Heartland Rock itself.
The mid to late 80s, this is when Mellencamp fully cemented his status as the voice of the American Heartland. But this wasn't, you know, an organic thing. It was an incredibly deliberate, conscious, artistic decision. It all began with the landmark 1985 album Scarecrow.
Scarecrow represented a major sonic pivot away from the polished pop of the earlier Cougar years. It was a deep, almost academic connection to deeper American roots music. Our sources say he was almost obsessive about getting the sound right.
He was entirely focused. Mellencamp consciously aimed to incorporate the authentic sound and feel of classic 1960s rock into Scarecrow, and the preparation for it involved this remarkable exercise.
What did he do?
He gave his band close to 100 old singles to learn almost mathematically verbatim before they even started recording. He wanted them to internalize the groove, the rhythm, the arrangements of those Roots records to make sure the album sounded both authentic and timeless.
That diligence certainly paid off commercially. Scarecrow peaked at number 2 on the charts. It spun off 5 top 40 singles.
Lonely All Night, Small Town, and of course the instantly recognizable R.O.C.K. in the USA.
It also marks a major personal milestone for him, doesn't it?
Yes. This commitment to his identity extended to his operations. Scarecrow was the first album recorded entirely at his own newly constructed private studio, which he jokingly called Belmont Mall in Belmont, Indiana.
So this physical move recording at home in the heart of Indiana was as much an artistic statement as music itself. He was refusing to be tied to the LA or New York music establishment.
Absolutely. But what is truly groundbreaking here, and what really demands our closest attention, is his contentious claim about Scarecrow's role in music history. He believes this album and the sound it pioneered is the genesis of alternative country.
He's never backed down from that, has he?
Never. He stated, "I think I invented that whole no depression thing, though I don't get the credit." And while that might sound like a bold, self-aggrandizing claim, the critical analysis actually supports his role as a pivotal innovator.
So how does the analysis confirm this? What specific elements did he combine that made his music the blueprint for what we now call alt country or roots rock?
Well, Anthony DeCurtis, among others, specifically noted that Mellencamp pioneered the core sound of the alternative country or no depression movement. He did this by taking traditional folk and roots instruments, the dulcimer, the mandolin, the fiddle, the accordion, and marrying them aggressively with the driving rock framework of his powerhouse band.
So it was the first time these acoustic instruments weren't just, like, ornaments.
Exactly. They were lead instruments fighting the electric guitars for space. It was this contrast, the Appalachian instruments fighting the classic rock attack, that was a fundamental clash of genres that really shouldn't have worked, but he made it his signature.
It was revolutionary. Before Mellencamp, roots music and rock were often kept separate. He blurred those lines on Scarecrow, and then even more on the Lonesome Jubilee and Big Daddy.
He brought the rural front and center, but gave it this modern, politically aware punch.
So if he was the originator of this sound, why doesn't he get the credit? This is where that music industry irony comes in, right?
It's the ultimate irony. Critics have observed that he committed the unforgivable sin of having too many hits while pioneering an anti-commercial genre. The mythology of the No Depression movement, you know, it often requires the artists to be marginalized or starving or forgotten, this kind of authenticity tax.
But Mellencamp achieved massive commercial success while forging the blueprint. So he was instantly branded as mainstream rock, despite the fact that he was integrating acoustic Americana deeper than any of his contemporaries.
He was too successful to be critically cool in the niche world that he created.
And that successful, deeply rooted identity immediately translated into the most powerful and enduring activist work of his career, Farm Aid.
It was the perfect synergy of music and mission. Mellencamp co-founded Farm Aid with Willie Nelson and Neil Young in September 1985. The catalyst was the severe agricultural crisis of the 80s, where small family farms were just being crushed by debt.
And that initial concert in Champaign, Illinois, really kicked off a movement. What made Farm Aid different from other big charity concerts of that era?
Its focus. Unlike, you know, Live Aid, Farm Aid was hyper-specific, focused on an American domestic issue. It wasn't just about donating money. It was about political advocacy, educational resources, and maintaining the cultural fabric of the heartland.
That sustained commitment. Nearly $80 million raised and 39 years running shows, this was never a fad. It was a defining lifetime mission for the founders.
And this political commitment then fully infused his evolving sound. He refined the heartland approach with 1987's The Lonesome Jubilee.
This is when a new, critical piece of instrumentation solidified the signature sound, with the addition of fiddle player Lisa Germano.
Right. She joined before the 85-86 tour. Her impact was massive. She stayed until 1994 and then, you know, returned decades later.
And Lonesome Jubilee is where that signature sound truly coalesced. How was it structurally different from Scarecrow?
The Lonesome Jubilee synthesized all the experimental pieces into a perfected form. The sound became defined by that constant mix of acoustic and electric guitars, the essential Appalachian fiddle from Germano, gospel-style backing vocals, all still anchored by that crisp, bare-knuckled drum beat.
It felt traditional, yet powerful and modern. Singles like Paper and Fire and Cherry Bomb really exemplified that blend.
Yeah. And this era concludes with the 1989 album Big Daddy, which Mellencamp considered perhaps his most personal and stripped-down effort yet.
He called it the most earthy record he'd ever made. It had tracks like Jackie Brown and Pop Singer. But critically, he chose not to tour behind the album.
Right. And that decision signaled a major shift in focus and priorities, moving away from the rock star treadmill. He referred to this time as one of agony, saying that out of that personal pain came a couple of really beautiful songs.
And instead of touring, he devoted that time to another artistic pursuit, which confirms the unity of his vision across different mediums.
His focus shifted entirely to painting. His 1990 exhibition featured these portraits that, according to observers, conveyed the same disillusionment found in his musical anthems. So whether he was writing lyrics or mixing oils, the themes of struggle, authenticity, and the disappearing American dream were always consistent. This signaled the final push to drop that manufactured moniker for good. So by the beginning of the 1990s, the battle was finally over. The transformation from Johnny Cougar to John Mellencamp was complete. And this arrival signaled a period of greater artistic freedom, marked by genre exploration and a pretty severe personal reckoning.
The moment of victory was so symbolic. The 1991 album, Whenever We Wanted, was the first album cover billed solely and officially to John Mellencamp.
No more Cougar. No more hybrid name. The identity he was born with was finally the identity he presented to the world.
And this freedom allowed him to explore different avenues in the mid-90s, proving his adaptability. The 1994 album Dance Naked had a significant career highlight, his cover of Van Morrison's Wild Night.
And it was a massive commercial success, showing he still had that pop viability even while maintaining his new artistic standard.
The duet, with Michelle and Gigiocello, it brought this interesting funk and R&B vibe to the track.
Yeah, and it became his biggest hit in years, peaking at number 3 on the Hot 100. It demonstrates this perfect duality. He could deliver that commercial pop success while simultaneously putting politically heavy tracks like LUV and another Sunny Day 1225 on the same album.
But that combination of pop appeal and protest was sharply interrupted that same year by a very serious health scare that forced a reckoning with his rock and roll lifestyle.
A minor heart attack in August 1994, immediately following a show in New York. It forced him to cancel the rest of the Dance Naked tour. And the context he later provided for this is brutally honest. It really illustrates the unsustainable pressures of fame and touring.
It's striking how often the source material refers to his intense self-destructive habits during that period.
He was completely candid about it. He attributed the heart attack directly to his lifestyle and his extreme smoking habit. I was up to 80 cigarettes a day, he said. We'd finish a show and I'd go out and have steak and French fries and eggs at 4 in the morning and then go to sleep with all that in my gut.
At 42, his body just forced a complete immediate stop.
And this forced pause, this brush with mortality, it led to an artistic reboot that was pure Mellencamp. He returned to touring in early 1995, but not to arenas. He played small Midwestern clubs under a pseudonym.
He toured as Pearl Doggy.
Pearl Doggy. It was more than just anonymity. It was like a purification ritual. After facing his own mortality and the pressures of superstardom, the Pearl Doggy tour was a way to strip away the expectations, reconnect with the core experience of performance, and just play music for the joy of it.
That willingness to shed the image and experiment continued in the studio with the 1996 album Mr. Happy-Go-Lucky. This album signaled he wasn't just returning to form. He was actively pushing his sound into new, unexpected territories.
He took a huge risk by collaborating with dance and pop producer Junior Vasquez. The critically acclaimed Mr. Happy-Go-Lucky infused his acoustic roots rock with drum loops, synthesizers, trip-hop elements. It created a sound that was surprisingly modern for a Heartland icon.
It showed he was willing to sacrifice sonic continuity for artistic novelty.
And that experimental shift paid off. It gave him his final top 40 hit, Key West Intermezzo, I Saw You First. A year later, he made a major business move, shifting to a new label.
Signed a 4-album deal with Columbia Records, which started with his 1998 self-titled debut for the label.
And this era also marked a big change in the band dynamic. Dane Clark replaced the longtime legendary drummer Kenny Aronoff.
But even with those professional shifts, he remained profoundly tied to Indiana. The university even recognized him as an institution.
Oh, absolutely. In May 2000, Indiana University recognized his cultural impact by giving him an honorary doctorate of musical arts. And his advice to the graduates was just simple and perfectly aligned with his lifelong pursuit of authenticity. Play it as you feel it.
And speaking of authenticity and giving back, we have to spend a moment on the incredible Good Samaritan tour in 2000. It sounds less like a rock tour and more like an impromptu folk pilgrimage.
It was a beautiful expression of his anti-commercial ethos. He played a series of completely unannounced free concerts in city parks across the East Coast and Midwest. This was a deliberate attempt to connect directly with fans, bypassing the entire infrastructure of ticket sales, security, and stadium pomp.
What was the setup like? What did that stripped-down aesthetic communicate?
He used a truly lo-fi setup, portable amps, a battery-powered PA system, an acoustic guitar, and was accompanied only by an accordionist and a violist.
Wow.
The entire experience was raw, intimate, and immediate. It communicated that the music, the message, and the connection with the audience were what mattered, not the scale of the production. He was reclaiming the simplicity of the folk tradition.
This era also shows him collaborating extensively, stepping outside the boundaries of Heartland rock into hip-hop and country.
On his 2001 album, Cuttin' Heads, he showed incredible versatility, working with Chuck D of Public Enemy and India, Airy on the single Peaceful World. He also had a notable duet with country star Trisha Yearwood on Deep Blue Heart.
It confirms that by the 2000s, he was an artist comfortable engaging with all these diverse musical conversations, respected by every corner of the industry.
Yeah, and his subsequent album, Trouble No More, in 2003, was a pure, quickly recorded tribute to the American folk and blues source material that fed his entire root sensibility.
A heartfelt project.
It featured covers of vintage tracks by giants like Robert Johnson, Sunhouse, Lucinda Williams, and Hoagy Carmichael. It was dedicated to his late friend, Billboard editor Timothy White, who passed away in 2002. Mellencamp had performed some of those covers at White's benefit, and the energy was so compelling that Columbia encouraged him to record a full album. it was a direct link back to his musical heroes. Around 2008, Mellencamp enters his next definitive phase, which we can really call the T-Bone Burnett era. This partnership marks some of the most critically praised, sonically innovative, and conceptually daring work of his entire career.
T-Bone Burnett is known for creating these atmosphere-heavy, deeply resonant roots albums. And Mellencamp's 2008 album, Life, Death, Love, and Freedom, was the first result of this pairing.
It immediately elevated his critical standing. The album debuted at number 7 on the Billboard 200, and Rolling Stone was highly complimentary, naming it the number 5 best album of 2008.
So the collaboration with Burnett, it injected a new sense of urgency and sonic texture into his work.
It felt darker, more existential, more lyrically dense than some of his earlier output.
But the peak of this innovative partnership, and maybe the most technically fascinating work of his career, has to be the 2010 album, No Better Than This. The concept behind this album is truly unique in modern recording history.
It's an artistic commitment that goes way beyond standard production. Mellencamp and Burnett decided to record the tracks entirely in historic, resonant locations across the American South.
These weren't studios.
No, not at all. They were places imbued with American musical history, including the First African Baptist Church in Savannah, Georgia, the legendary Sun Studio in Memphis, and most evocatively, the Sheraton Gunter Hotel in San Antonio.
Specifically, in the room where blues pioneer Robert Johnson made some of his pivotal recordings.
Exactly.
Recording in those locations is one thing, but the technical constraints they imposed on themselves, I mean, it makes the process sound like a logistical nightmare. It's almost like performance art.
That's the key. They used incredibly vintage and specific equipment, a 1955 Ampex portable recording machine, and only one microphone.
One microphone.
Think about that for a moment. This technical constraint required all the musicians, guitars, drums, bass, vocals, to literally gather together and perform simultaneously around that single mic, forcing an intimacy and an attention to dynamics that is entirely absent in modern multi-track recording.
That sounds terrifying. It requires absolute perfection in performance.
Yeah.
What was the artistic intent behind that level of difficulty?
It was about capturing a raw, authentic sound that couldn't be achieved otherwise. It eliminated the endless safety net of digital editing and overdubs. The entire album was recorded and mixed entirely in mono.
Which is a massive statement in the modern digital age.
It's insisting on a sound reproduction method that was largely abandoned 50 years prior.
And the commercial outcome reflected the boldness of that artistic decision.
It was an incredible achievement, no better than Mobisho. This was the first mono-only release to crack the Billboard Top 10 since James Brown's Pure Dynamite, live at the Royal way back in 1964. It showed that Mellencamp, at this stage of his career, was willing to prioritize sonic authenticity and artistic concept over convenience or modern convention, and the audience rewarded that effort.
And his touring structure for this album was just as innovative as the recording method. He turned a standard rock concert into an entire thoughtful evening of immersive entertainment.
The No Better Than This theater tour, which ran for 2 years, was structured in this highly unique three-part format. It began with screening a documentary by Kurt Marcus about the album's creation.
Right.
Then Mellencamp would hit the stage for a stripped-down acoustic set with the band, followed by a solo acoustic set, and finally concluding with a fully electrified rock set. He wanted the audience to experience the entire sonic journey, from the historical roots to the modern rock sound.
This era also saw him trading praise and sharing stages with some of the biggest names in American songwriting, confirming his status among the elite.
In 2010, he co-headlined 11 shows with Bob Dylan. And Dylan, who is famously reticent to praise his contemporaries, delivered arguably the highest compliment Mellencamp has ever received.
Regarding which song?
His 2008 song, Longest Days. Dylan called it one of the better songs of the last few years, actually. I ain't lying.
I mean, for a songwriter, getting that from Dylan.
It's everything. Mellencamp later said that Dylan's simple, unvarnished endorsement was worth more to him than if he had received 10 Grammys. That level of peer validation from an artist like Dylan, it just cements his legacy.
He continued his tributes and collaborations in later years, doing acoustic covers of Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited in 2015 and Billy Joel's Allentown in 2014 for tribute events.
And his later works maintained this mix of collaboration and deep roots exploration. The 2017 album Sad Clowns and Hillbillies was a duets album with Carlene Carter,
the daughter of June Carter Cash.
Right, who also opened his tour. It brought this direct lineage to country royalty to the project.
And this album features an incredibly cool, almost archival connection to the grand tradition of American folk music via Woody Guthrie.
This is a point of real historical significance. Mellencamp wrote the music for the song My Soul's Got Wings, setting a previously unheard lyric written by the legendary folk singer Woody Guthrie to music.
So he's actively participating in the preservation and continuation of the American folk tradition.
Exactly, linking his heartland rock directly back to the populist roots of the Depression era.
And moving into his most recent work in the 2020s, he teamed up with another iconic figure, one he's often compared to, Bruce Springsteen.
Springsteen contributed significantly to the 2022 album, Strictly a One-Eyed Jack. He sang and played guitar on three songs, including the lead single, Wasted Days.
A powerful collaboration on a song about aging and mortality, written and produced solely by Mellencamp. Seeing those two voices grappling with the passage of time on the same track was like a generational moment.
It really was. And his 2023 album, Orpheus Descending, even takes its name from Greek mythology, signaling a deeper contemplation of the role of the artist.
Orpheus, the skilled singer and songwriter whose music can charm the world.
By naming his album after this figure, Mellencamp is consciously addressing his own enduring role as a powerful voice. The album included potent, politically charged new songs like Hey God and The Eyes of Portland, which is a powerful, direct diatribe against homelessness and societal neglect.
And we get that beautiful full circle moment with the return of an essential band member from the Scarecrow era.
Yes, the return of Lisa Germano, the violinist who defined his heartland sound from 85 to 93. She returned to play violin on Orpheus Descending and the accompanying 2023 tour. This was her first studio album with him in 30 years.
Since 1993's Human Wheels, it's a powerful validation of the tight creative circles Mellencamp maintains. Key collaborators often come back home. Let's delve into some of the human relationships that shaped his hit-making run, especially the unique and complicated partnership with his childhood friend, George Greene.
George Greene was integral to the most successful period of Mellencamp's career. He co-wrote several of his absolute biggest, most iconic hits.
Hurts So Good, Crumbling Down, and crucially, Pink Houses.
Right. Greene often contributed the foundational lyrics and ideas that Mellencamp would then set to music.
But despite their deep shared history, I mean, they were both born and raised in Seymour, Indiana, their partnership came to this abrupt end with a falling out in the early 2000s. It's always difficult when deep friendship and professional collaboration collide.
Mellencamp addressed the split publicly, indicating how complex it was. He said, "There were personal problems, cross-pollinated with professional issues." He acknowledged that Greene had contributed great lyrics, but he simply just couldn't do it anymore.
And their final collaboration was Yours Forever, on the Perfect Storm soundtrack in 2000.
It really speaks to the difficulty of sustaining high-stakes creative collaboration, even between lifelong friends.
Tragically, Greene died in 2011 at age 59 from cancer. How did Mellencamp reflect on the end of that partnership and Greene's passing?
He was mournful, remembering their shared history. He said, "I've known George since we were in the same Sunday school class." He spoke of the fun they had and the really good songs they wrote together, characterizing Greene as a dreamer. Despite the professional split, the personal weight of losing a childhood friend was clearly very heavy.
Beyond his recording and songwriting career, Mellencamp has consistently explored film, theater, and painting. It shows a broad and restless artistic temperament. He's known for his visual art, but he also tried his hand at acting and directing.
He appeared in four films, including Falling from Grace in 1992, which he also directed. But the truly fascinating part of the segment is the massive career opportunities he chose to reject. In 1980, he rejected the lead role in The Idolmaker.
Why?
He was worried that if he made too much money, he'd lose the motivation to continue writing and recording. That's a powerful statement about artistic integrity over easy income.
And then there's the famous anecdote about the role that ultimately launched a global superstar.
Yes, he was offered the Brad Pitt role, the handsome hitchhiker J.D. in Ridley Scott's classic film, Thelma and Louise.
No way.
Yes. Mellencamp told VH1 that when he read the script, he thought, "I get it, but I don't want to take my shirt off."
That's incredible. He turned down a career-defining role for a reason related entirely to, what, image control?
I think so. His reflection afterwards was wry. He said, "So Brad Pitt took his shirt off, and look what happened to Brad Pitt. I was that close." It highlights the intersection of celebrity, image, and the path not taken. Mellencamp always sought to control his image, preferring the grizzled, authentic songwriter over the Hollywood heartthrob.
Shifting to composition, he also wrote the entire film score for the 2015 Meg Ryan movie Ithaca, which shows a dedication to an entirely different form of musical output.
The entire score. He focused on period-specific music because the film was set during World War II. Meg Ryan, his partner at the time, confirmed that not one note in Ithaca is anything other than Mellencamp.
He wrote two original songs for it as well.
He did. Sugar Hill Mountain, sung by Carlene Carter, and a 1940s sounding standard, Seeing You Around, sung by the late, great Leon Redbone.
His exploration continued into musical theater, a huge pivot for a roots rocker, by collaborating with horror author Stephen King.
He teamed up with King on the Southern Gothic musical Ghost Brothers of Darkland County, which debuted in 2012. And the musical was unique for its aesthetic. It intentionally got rid of a traditional orchestra using a simplified rock instrumentation, just two twangy acoustic guitars, accordion, and a fiddle.
A simplified raw sound that aligns perfectly with his heartland aesthetic.
Exactly. Reviewers noted it was perhaps the first ever musical written by men for men, reflecting the dark, simplified Southern Gothic narrative favored by both Mellencamp and King.
We must now pivot to his consistent and sometimes confrontational political stances. Mellencamp has never shied away from using his platform, holding staunch liberal views, and supporting the Democratic Party.
His political visibility really peaked during the early Iraq War era. In 2003, he became one of the first major entertainers, alongside Sheryl Crow and the Dixie Chicks, to publicly oppose the war.
That was a highly dangerous and unpopular position to take in the immediate post-9/11 climate, especially for an artist whose core audience included many conservatives.
And he definitely felt the backlash, even from within his own loyal fan base. He revealed later that conservative fans sometimes openly booed him at concerts for criticizing President George W. Bush.
His 2003 song To Washington was very critical of the war.
And after its release, he cited hearing a caller on the radio say, "I don't know who I hate the most, John Mellencamp or Osama bin Laden." That quote just illustrates the truly visceral, polarized reaction his political music could elicit.
And the most famous clash involving his political message concerns his biggest song, the widely misinterpreted anthem, Pink Houses.
He has constantly expressed annoyance that the song's critical, complicated lyrics, Ain't That America, for you and me, were stripped of context and used as a simplistic, saccharine, patriotic anthem, completely ignoring the critique of economic disparity and disappointment in the verses.
And that misinterpretation came to a head in the 2008 election cycle.
When John McCain's presidential campaign started using both Our Country and Pink Houses at rallies, Mellencamp's team immediately demanded they stop. And this wasn't just a standard artist objection. His publicist released a statement that clearly articulated the political dissonance.
That statement is critical because it precisely defines his political intention.
The statement argued that if McCain was a true conservative, he should stop playing songs containing a populist pro-labor message written by a guy who would find no argument if you characterized him as an ardent leftist.
So that was Mellencamp himself, through his representative, defining his songs as progressive political tools.
Which forced the campaign to immediately pull the tracks from their playlists.
More recently, he supported Michael Bloomberg's 2020 campaign, allowing the use of Small Town in an ad. And in 2020, he reworked a classic Bob Dylan protest song to address contemporary racial conflict.
Following the murder of George Floyd, he released A Pawn in the White Man's Game, a reworking of Dylan's 1964 song Only a Pawn in Their Game. Mellencamp's version included new lyrics reflecting the recent conflicts and the historical struggles faced by minorities in the country. He has always viewed his role as a songwriter as one who must address these issues head on, regardless of the commercial consequence. Mellencamp's career provides this fascinating blueprint for how a roots rocker can maintain decades of mass popularity while fiercely demanding artistic authenticity and political engagement. And the critical reception and the accolades he's earned late in his career really reflect this unique and powerful balance.
The accolades are impressive, not just from critics, but from other music legends. Timothy White, the Billboard editor and his late friend, called him arguably the most important roots rocker of his generation.
White praised Mellencamp for his groundbreaking work in making folk instruments like fiddles and accordions lead rock instruments, and for bringing a raw Appalachian lyrical outlook to his songwriting. White said Mellencamp's best music is rock and roll stripped of all escapism, forcing the listener to look directly at the messiness of life as it's actually lived.
He's the anti-fantasy rock star.
Exactly. And the praise came from the very top echelons of both country and rock royalty.
Johnny Cash called him one of the 10 best songwriters in music.
And John Fogerty, the former Creedence Clearwater Revival frontman, praised him as one of the great American songwriters in a great rock spirit, specifically noting his feisty nature that shines through in songs like Authority Song. This consistent high praise from artists across genres is a testament to his unique standing.
And this influence wasn't just, you know, theoretical admiration. It actively shaped the careers of younger artists, perhaps most notably country star Keith Urban.
Urban has consistently cited Mellencamp as a major transformative influence. He points specifically to Mellencamp's 1988 Lonesome Jubilee Tour stop in Australia as an epiphany.
What exactly was the aha moment for Urban when he watched Mellencamp perform that night?
Urban realized that Mellencamp gave himself permission to fuse all of his diverse interests. Urban said that the concert showed him, "I get it, just put all the things you love into what you do."
It was the permission to blend country, rock, and folk instrumentation without having to adhere to genre constraints.
Precisely. And Urban's own 2015 hit single, John Cougar, John Deere, John 3.16, is a direct, affectionate illustration of that influence.
Beyond the musical recognition, Mellencamp's career is dotted with honors that reflect not just his musical genius, but his lifelong commitment to the common man.
Beyond the Rock Hall and Songwriters Hall of Fame, he has the Woody Guthrie Award from 2003 and the Woody Guthrie Prize from 2018. The association with Guthrie really underscores his commitment to social justice and the folk tradition.
But the John Steinbeck Award is perhaps the most telling reflection of his cultural legacy.
He received it in 2012, an honor given to individuals who exemplify Steinbeck's empathy, commitment to democratic values, and belief in the dignity of the common man. I mean, that perfectly encapsulates the voice of disillusionment and resilience found in songs like Pink Houses and the whole Farm Aid Mission.
And let's revisit the Rock Hall induction ceremony in 2008. Billy Joel inducted him, and his speech was this direct, famous challenge to Mellencamp to never compromise his anger.
Joel urged him, "Stay ornery, stay mean. We need you to be pissed off and restless because no matter what they tell us, we know this country is going to hell in a handcart." Joel recognized that Mellencamp's value to American culture lay in his refusal to be satisfied, his willingness to echo the discontent of the heartland.
Finally, we have some insight into the man behind the icon, confirming his continued ties to Indiana despite his global fame.
Mellencamp has been married 3 times. Has 5 children, including his daughter, Teddy Mellencamp Arroyo, who gained some notoriety on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Right.
His personal life post-divorce include high-profile relationships with Meg Ryan and Christie Brinkley, but he remains firmly rooted near Bloomington, Indiana, on Lake Monroe, maintaining that deep connection to his home state, while also keeping an art studio loft in Soho, NYC. It's a perfect embodiment of the small-town man with global ambitions.
So we've tracked the entire remarkable trajectory from the reluctantly commercial manufactured Johnny Cougar through the decades-long battle for his identity and the formation of the legendary band.
To the successful pioneering of alternative country and the unwavering activism of Farm Aid.
All the way to his T-Bone. Burnett produced mono masterpieces and his recent collaborations with Bruce Springsteen.
It remains the central paradox of his career. He was simultaneously a highly successful mainstream artist, giving him the massive hits that powered his career, while also, often single-handedly, pioneering what were fundamentally anti-commercial genres like No Depression.
He achieved mass popularity by digging deeper into authentic American roots, rather than trying to escape them or, you know, sanitize them for the pop charts.
It makes you wonder about the essential role of deep personal struggle in achieving that authenticity that people like Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan praised. Mellencamp himself once said that out of his personal agony came a couple of really beautiful songs.
So when you consider his history, the forced early identity crisis, the intense political engagement that alienated conservative fans, and that dramatic heart attack at age 22 that forced him to confront his own mortality, how much does that personal struggle fuel the raw, lived-in authenticity of the Heartland story? And is that level of real, enduring frustration a necessary ingredient for achieving the kind of lasting, influential legacy he commands?
That's something we're thinking about the next time you hear one of his anthems.